Okay, colleagues, members of the audience, those of you living the good life, I want to welcome you to this Friday, May 3rd, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education Workforce Development. It is a delight to have you here today on this delightful day. We have some special guests who've come all the way from Eastern Oregon to talk to us about the Eastern Promise, and thank you very much for doing that. So with that, I will open this informational meeting on the Eastern Promise, creating early college experiences for students in Eastern Oregon. How's that for a title?
Excellent.
Okay,
right,
would you come up, gentlemen? And this committee has met Presidents Turner and Davies already, but not yet you, Mark. So we're delighted to have you here.
I was elected to be the leadoff hitter, so I'll start. Good morning, Chairperson Dimbro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Davies. I have the pleasure and honor of serving as the president of Eastern Oregon University and have done so for the last 4 years, so I consider this to be my senior year. Hopefully I'll get going to graduate school too, so we'll see what happens. Today, and I would like to thank you very, very much for inviting us to come over and talk about something that is very, very near and dear, excuse me, near and dear to my heart, something that's very near and dear that I have a very, very strong passion for, and that is creating and generating a college-going culture throughout all of Oregon, not just in Eastern Oregon, but throughout the entire state. My job today is to talk a little bit about the history of how we started this process, this project, give you a very broad overview from the university perspective. Then I'll turn to John Turner, the president of Blue Mountain Community College, to have him talk about the perspective of a community college president and how it functions in his area. And then we'll turn it over to Mark Moldova-Hill to talk about it from the K-12 perspective. And I think that's a really interesting part about this. There's a lot of opportunities to for organizations, for universities to create college-going readiness, to do dual credits, and we do it in isolation. Community colleges do the same type of thing, and they do it in isolation. And K-12 also tries to empower their students to go into higher education, but it's always done in isolation. What the Eastern Promise does is bring it all together. So a little history. Two and a half years ago, after the Christmas break, I called my good friends John Turner, president of BMCC, Dana Young, the president of Treasure Valley Community College, and Mark Moldova-Hill, the director of the Intermountain ESD, and proposed a very simple challenge to them that perplexed all of us and actually also and frustrated all of us. The simple challenge was, how do we work together, the key word, work together, to change the trend of the number of individuals throughout Eastern Oregon, throughout rural Oregon, who earned college degrees, either at the AA level or the bachelor's degree level. We came together in the back room of a truck stop, a Greasy Spoon restaurant. We did that because budgets were tight and I was buying lunch. And we talked about the challenges. We talked about the obstacles. And one by one, we started to address those challenges and obstacles. And it's amazing what you can do when you lock individuals in a room with bad chili and bad coffee. And over a fairly brief period of time, we came up with answers to all those obstacles and challenges. In that small room, we developed an idea of the Eastern Promise, and we initiated the pilot phase. Two very important principles came out of that meeting. The first objective was to is a very simple statement, to increase the college-going culture of rural Oregon through the development of a comprehensive set of plans and actions starting in the fifth grade and continuing throughout the senior year in high school, targeting students, their families, the teachers, and most importantly as well, the communities that support those students. Objective number two, and I have to admit that was my objective. I think broad spectrum, and that was something I really came up with. The second objective was really the brainchild of Mark here, and that was to increase access to early college credit experiences in high schools with the Eastern Promise Initiative to develop our Credit by Proficiency program. Credit by Proficiency is intended to be our Eastern Promise version of advanced placement. Our process set up a system to select, train, evaluate both teachers and student performance. Mark always talked about the senior year of the high schools and how many of those that year was wasted due to already the requirements being met. And so that was something that he brought to the table. The Eastern Promise started before this whole K-20 initiative. It also started at the onset of the 40-40-20. This was our version of how do we change a culture. But with the Eastern Promise, it is the K-20 pipeline. It is about achieving 40-40-20 throughout the entire state. It's about providing access to underserved populations. It's about serving first-generation college students. It's about providing equitable access to higher educational opportunities to rural students that urban and suburbanite students may already have. It's about lowering the total cost of higher education to our students of Oregon, who are most economically disadvantaged. It's about instilling the confidence in the students, their families, and their communities that a college degree is achievable and obtainable. To achieve these laudable goals, it is my belief, and this is another part of the Eastern Promise, is we are redefining what college ready really means. So what does college ready mean to most individuals? Most individuals, it means that you've taken a couple dual credits and you're ready to go. We define college ready a little bit differently. It's not the mere attainment of dual credit in high school. The attributes that better define an individual as college ready are those individual students are able to attend a university without remedial attention, that they have the personal drive, they have the social drive, and they also have the mindset to, in fact, graduate from the university. It's not just about the academics, it's about the individual and the social systems as well. This is a new and different approach for the Eastern Promise as compared to regular dual credit for advanced placement efforts. It is a focus and strategic focus of a comprehensive approach to college readiness. The goals, objectives, and strategies of the Eastern Promise are to enable individuals to be completely college ready. As the literature and research indicates, there are three areas that make up college readiness. These are academic readiness. The individual has the skills and knowledge required without remedial courses for the content and requirements for all first-year college students. Personnel readiness. The individual has the mindset and disposition to obtain a college degree. They are aware of, they are able to, and handle the personal sacrifice and challenges that will arise during their studies and are committed to persevere and earn a college degree. And then social support. The individual has the family or other sources of social support that will be required to succeed in college. A college journey is not meant to be done solely alone and a foray into the woods. Rather, the individual must have a team support that is willing and able to offer support and guidance when needed to. Not just when asked, but able to respond even when they're not asked. The Eastern Promise will be successful when all three of these elements are in place and are able to, for all students throughout Oregon, the personal readiness, the social readiness, and the academic readiness. A key part about our success in the Eastern Promise is that it's done locally, and it's very done with a collaborative approach. Beyond the comprehensive viewpoint of college readiness, an additional imperative element of the Eastern Promise is that we all work together in a very localized way. The Eastern Promise, from the initial meetings and concept, was developed on the leadership of the university. Many of these efforts, when you look across the country, are done at departments, are done at the dean's level or lower, a department chair coming together and working out. Our efforts are done at the presidential level, and that is extremely important because it's not just a department committed to it, it is the actual institution. And in this way, we are able to operate collectively and effectively. We do it based on what is best for our students and what is best for the region as a whole. We don't have a memorandum of understanding between the three entities. We have handshakes. We look each other in the eye and make decisions based on what is best for the students and what is best for the region. And also in doing so, we have made a commitment that our decisions in the Eastern Promise is not just a program that's outside of our institutions. To me, and I know John feels the same way, as does Dana at Treasure Valley and Mark as well, it is the way that we will operate now, next year, the year after, and for decades to come. As a result, we have created sustaining infrastructures that span all of our areas. And we do have, in fact, a K-20 pipeline. We have academic disciplines working together through the professional learning communities, where the faculty of the Eastern Oregon University, the faculty of the community colleges, the teachers of the high schools get together, and they talk about the challenges and obstacles that they face and even come up with their own solutions. The PLCs, as we call them, are a rigorous outcome of our efforts. And Mark will talk a lot more about the professional development opportunities that has provided the high school teachers. It was an unintended and a very positive consequence of us coming together. It is also through our constant communication and connection at the executive level that we have multiple schools and students have further localized our approach. As a result of this, the communities have become engaged, and because of this, the importance of our efforts is throughout the entire community. Just yesterday, starting at 7:30 in the morning and ending at 5 o'clock last night, I personally visited 4 different elementary schools, 2 different middle schools, 3 different high schools, all in the Hermiston area. And in each of those areas, the teachers, the principals all talked about the Eastern Promise and how it has had a direct impact on their faculty and their staff, and most importantly, their students and their families. I had parents come up to me talking with tears in their eyes, knowing that their son would be able to finally achieve a college degree. Their son was in the fifth grade. Another family came up to me and talked about how their daughter, a sixth grader, now has dreams of going to Juilliard. Will she make Juilliard? I have no idea. But the fact that she even knows Juilliard, the fact that she had the guts to get up in front of the group and sing because she wanted to practice her audition, tells us it's working. Our efforts in the Eastern Promise are intentional. We are very specific in what we want to achieve. We have goals set out. We have ideas set out. And every week we come together as presidents, every Tuesday morning at 7:30, if you want to join us on the phone, to talk about how we're doing, where we're going, and what the next steps will be. The Eastern Promise is sustainable. It is sustainable because of the commitment of the leadership at the institutions and how we have built it into our own strategic fabric. It is also scalable. This is not a unique concept that can only work in one or two areas. We receive calls nearly on a weekly basis from high schools and school districts throughout the entire state. We are looking at ways to transport this up through Tillamook to Coos Bay and all points in between. And to me, that's very, very important. The school districts are clamoring for this type of collaboration. The community colleges are clamoring for this type of collaboration. And we work with the other universities. President Mary Cullen is with me tonight because we work with the Southern as well as best as we can to move these type of ideas forward. This is not a monopoly with Eastern Oregon University, Blue Mountain, Treasure Valley. It is how we move the entire state forward. It is also going to be sustainable because we evaluate each and every action we take. We set out the expectations, and then we see where the results are, and then we measure the gap between the two, and then make adjustments as needed. In this pilot phase, as Mark and John will talk about, right now the gap is actually on the positive side. We are receiving more credits, more requests for credits, and more students than we anticipated in the pilot phase, and so we know that we're able to move forward. As we look legislatively, Senate Bill 222 is a platform for this work to continue. It's very important for that to move forward. We also look at House Bill 3232, again, another very important bill to further continue this work. So as you continue your deliberations and your thought process, the Eastern Promise is an ideal model that is working, that is combining the K-20 model. It is set up to be achievable for 40-40-20. Most importantly, it is able for us to offer higher education opportunities throughout the entire state to school districts that have 400, 500, 1,000, as well as Burnt River School District with all 32 students. And that's the entire school district, not just in high school. And we're able to offer those programs to all of our citizens, which is what we need to be focused on doing. So again, this is something that's very passionate to me. It's about what higher education is set up to do, to be accessible, to be affordable, and to be the platform for us to be civically minded and move our region and our state forward. With that, I would now like to hand it over to John to talk about, from his perspective, at the community college level. John?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is John Turner. I'm wrapping up my 10th year at Blue Mountain Community College, where I serve as the president and I reside in Pendleton. I promise to talk a little bit about the mechanics of how the system actually works as we've set it up so far. So we know that prior to the Eastern Promise, there were 3 pathways to earning college credit while a student was in high school. One of those was through traditional dual credit as defined by the OAR and supervised by the State Board of Ed. The other one was expanded options where the school district paid the community college the full tuition for the course and the student attended as a college student. And the third one is advanced placement, which has been around forever, where the student takes the course and then takes a test and gets awarded credits based on how they do on that test. So those were the three pathways prior to the Eastern Promise. The Eastern Promise is based on credit by demonstrating proficiency, on how well the student can demonstrate that they've actually mastered the learning outcomes in the class. So we think this is going to do several things. I'll talk about the qualifications to teach under the Eastern Promise in just a moment. But we'll never get to 40-40-20 just based on those first three pathways I talked to you about, because they're very limiting on the number of students that a high school can put through, because there's a limited number of teachers that can teach under those. For instance, under dual credit, you need to have a master's degree in the subject matter. So in order to teach a college-level math class, you pretty much have to have a master's degree in math or engineering, something like that, that closely related field. And we just don't have enough of those teachers. The Eastern Promise is going to open up more teachers who are qualified to teach. We're going to have more sections and students, and we're going to have some opportunities out there in those rural schools that would never be able to have the qualified teachers. Those will now start to exist, like Bob was talking about in Burnt River. You know, they'd never be able to find a teacher with a master's degree in math. Well, not never, but it's pretty slim chances. So I've been here about 10 years, and I have not met one high school principal in my area that was happy with dual credit. It usually goes something like this. Why won't you let Mrs. Smith teach English for you guys? She's a wonderful teacher. She teaches AP for us, and her students do so well. What's wrong with you guys? And my answer has always been because there's an OAR that says she's not allowed to teach dual credit. It requires that she has a master's degree in her field. Now, I could hide behind the OAR, but what's really critical is that our accreditation standards hold us to a standard that says if you're going to let a high school teacher teach your courses and you're going to grant credits for them, that high school teacher needs to have the same qualifications that one of your on-campus instructor has. Or you have to do something special to show that they are qualified to teach. Okay, the Eastern Promise does that. Kind of getting behind my notes here, so let me catch up here a second. What credit for proficiency does in the Eastern Promise program is we say if we've got a good teacher and that teacher has a master's degree, even though it's probably going to be in education, we're going to let them teach. So given the math or the English example I used before, you got your undergrad degree in math or English, and you've got a master's degree in ed, which is very common. And if you're a good teacher, we'll know over time, because the students are going to take tests that are going to be designed to demonstrate the proficiency. And we'll know whether or not you're doing a good job. If you've got a very low pass rate, you're probably not doing a very good job. But if you're doing a good job, your students are passing the proficiency exams. And the way we keep this in line with accreditation is we bring all these teachers into these professional learning communities. You heard Bob a minute ago talk about PLCs. That's just an acronym that we throw around a lot. Professional learning communities for which Eastern Oregon University grants graduate credit for attending this. And in those professional learning communities, the college or university instructor is usually the chair, and they set what the learning outcomes are going to be and how we're going to measure those learning outcomes. And the high school teachers sit in there and they participate in determining what those are, but when they walk out the room, they know what the standards are and they know what they need to teach to as far as the learning outcomes are going to be. And they understand how, even more importantly, they're going to assess that proficiency. So you can see it's probably fairly easy to assess proficiency in a math class. You can either factor the equations or you can't. But how do you assess a speech class on whether or not a student's doing college-level work? In that particular case, they've decided to create a portfolio, and that portfolio is graded by teachers outside of the class. The teacher who teaches the class does not assess the proficiency of the student that goes to his or her class. So we decided we'd kick off this pilot program with four courses. And I'll tell you why we picked these four in just a moment, but it's the Math 111, which is college algebra, Communications 111, which we used to call Speech 111, a basic science class, And now I got to look at my notes to see what I'm writing out, the English composition. Okay, the reason why we picked those four is because they're all required for the AAOT. And here was one of the other problems with dual credit.
AAOT.
Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree. It's a two-year degree that sends you on to a four-year institution. So under dual credit, it was kind of hit or miss. Maybe you had a theater instructor who had a master's degree in fine arts in your high school who could teach dual credit theater, but maybe theater wasn't getting them anywhere. And maybe they weren't ever going to go into theater, and it wasn't going to satisfy any of the AAOT requirements. Under Eastern Promise, we're able to focus in on those areas that actually lead to degrees and certificates. So it's a far more productive way of trying to figure out which classes you want to offer under the Eastern Promise. The four PLCs, Professional Learning Community, started meeting in November of 2011, and they've grown. I think we've really been pleased at the way the teachers have worked together at both the university and college level with their high school counterparts. They've aligned the standards with what's being taught in the high schools. The high school teachers seem to understand what they need to do. My discussions with high school teachers is that they're very receptive to knowing what we expect from them from the college level. Just tell me what you want us to teach. I'll do my best to do it. But there was, under dual credit, there was a lot of uncertainty, I think would be the best way to say it. College instructors have greater confidence that the students that are coming out of the Eastern Promise have actually mastered college-level work, have actually done something at the college level than they did under the old dual credit program. Our early results are showing that we've got about 20 high schools that are participating with about 550 students. A little over 4,000 credits are projected to be awarded this year. 86 students are participating in the professional learning communities, and that number's growing. And 199 graduate credits to the students have been awarded by Eastern Oregon University through the process, and we expect that, of course, to expand. So I'll leave you with my thoughts on what the Eastern Promise is not. It's not for everybody. Not all students are going to be able to demonstrate that they can master the college-level learning outcomes. And not all students are going to be able to earn college credits, but a lot more will under this program than previously could. Not all teachers are going to be allowed to teach under the Eastern Promise, and we can check that a lot better now as we look at the outcomes over time and how well they're teaching their students. I think that in the wrap-up, Bob Davies is going to tell you that our pilot program is showing that pass rate is not as high as dual credit, so we're showing that there's a lot of rigor in these Eastern Promise classes. So that's my kind of wraps up my comments on how we're running the program. We're at the end of the pilot program this year. Dr. Mulvihill, Mark, is going to talk about what this means to students in their second, their last 2 years of the high school experience and what it's, how it interacts at the school district level. So that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thanks. Mark, before you begin, Rep. Johnson has
Thank
a question.
You, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your talk about PLCs. It's obviously in the K-12 world, that's really flourishing, growing phenomenon, and they're having great success, but I wasn't aware that they were actually being used to try to bring together post-secondary in the K-12. I think that's a great deal. So what you were saying then in terms of trying to determine whether a given instructor is suitable, let's say, for participating, you look at how the student performs in that standard proficiency exam or test, correct? That the PLC actually designs, right, to determine
correct
what are the criteria for success, for moving on and so forth. Is there just then simply a summative evaluation, or does this proficiency curriculum have formative assessments as they go through as well to determine whether the student is on track, or do we just simply wait till the end and hope they do well?
That's a great question. I didn't mean for it to sound that the teacher is solely judged on just how their students do. I'd like to let Mark talk to that since he's looking at these teachers at the K-12 level. But if I may, there was really no way to judge under the dual credit program whether or not a teacher was doing well or not. Mm-hmm. And so this provides us with a tool, a new tool, that I think is going to be very valuable.
I was going to answer that within mine. Do you want me?
That's fine. Okay, I'm sure we'll get it.
Okay. Because it's spot on what the core of the issue is. I'm Mark Thank you, Representative Denbro, on the committee. I'm Mark Mulvihill. I'm the superintendent of Intermountain ESD. And one of the benefits of the ESD is that our reach is very similar to Eastern's and Blue Mountains across the region. It's multiple counties, multiple districts, multiple kids that we impact.
Mark, before you go on, you might also tell people you're a member of the OEIB, and you were involved in the LearnWorks program, which a lot of this sounds quite relevant to.
It really does. Thank you. Yes, I'm a member of the OEIB and have been involved pretty much from day one with the LearnWorks as well. Key aspects of the LearnWorks, besides outcome-based budgeting, was this emphasis on proficiency. And we've really built our model around that. So it was, you know, how things kind of crystallize and come together. You know, we've all been at this a long time. And what we're going to talk about today, there probably isn't anything that's just earth-shattering. What's different about us is we pull it together and we're incredibly stubborn and persistent. And as Bob said, you know, we meet every week on phone. And it's not always pleasant conversations. It's arguing about assessments and kids entering and registrations and all the minutia. And we often say, you know, this is normally where we stop. And we retreat back into our silos and go back. This is where we stop. Are we going to persevere because we're getting pressure from this particular group? And we push through it. And I just want to clarify before I start, I don't remember you picking up the lunch.
I had the microphone at the time.
Exactly. So, really, I'm going to give you the perspective from the K-12, and John, you know, alluded a little bit to the principles. You know, and as a member of OEIB and as we've developed these achievement compacts, one of the big indicators for high schools is 9-plus college credits. They have to start measuring that. Well, that has raised the bar on the frustration level of the dual credit. And that's why it just seemed like everything, this was the perfect storm, it coalesced into moving the Eastern Promise ahead. But the Eastern Promise, what is critical is it's built upon a completion model. It's not just random dual credits. It's built on changing the senior year of high school, blending grades 11 to 14. That's one of our strategic initiatives, as you know, from OEIB. And redefining the 100-level series in our state. And I've often said it's my dream that no child eventually will have to pay for a 100-level class. Because as we move forward in K-12 with the Common Core, very clearly the Common Core is going to align. The senior year is going to become 100-level type standards and assessments as we move forward. And as our PLCs are working on it, they're keeping an eye on that. They're aligning the Common Core into the 100 series. But this is about being strategic so that kids finish, not just attend, not just get a few random credits to brag about to grandma. This is completion, and it's built upon the Oregon Transfer Module, the 45-credit module in Oregon that is across. So it's built on getting access, whether you go to school in Helix, Hermiston, Imbler, Baker, getting access for the 100-level core classes that every student needs, like Writing 121, Math 111, the ones we talked about. So what has been the barriers have been, besides we don't talk to each other and we have a tendency to quit when things get tough, one big thing has been the high school schedule. And, you know, as you know, you have to go in with the default that there's no such thing as a good high school schedule. Which one are you going to land on? But, you know, it's I can't do this because it's 4x4, or I don't align to Blue Mountain's calendar, or I don't, Treasure Valley does it this way, and Eastern does it this way. The proficiency arm has eliminated that conversation, because what it's done is it has said, here are the standards, here are the outcomes, and here's how we're going to measure it. And you can do what you want at your high school with your schedule. It could be a semester class. It could be a all-year class. Some are doing speech all year. Some are doing a half year. The bottom line is, here's the proficiency level. Mm. What we've done that's novel, really that is unique, are these PLCs. I don't know anywhere else where you have college faculty, community college, and 20 high school teachers arguing, and you know, we've laughed and said we're going to lock the door. We're going to let the fur fly, but you're coming out of there with aligned standards and outcomes. And the high schools are going to know very clearly what it's going to take to get 4K credits for writing 121. And we've done that. And here's the answer, Representative Johnson, to the PLC that I think is so exciting, that you know, the value add is the professional development that this, and the mutual respect that's been earned by faculty and staff. Is the writing 121, I think, is our success story. They meet throughout the year, and they actually go through individual student work and say, okay, in his narrative, he's a little weak here. I'm good with this part of the paper, but he needs to go back. So go back and have him fix that paper. He needs that. And the student gets multiple assessments. That's proficiency. There isn't a timeline. But these guys meet, and they go through student work and actually give feedback to the teachers in the region, and it becomes a teacher training component. The speech class, they do it electronically. They tape speeches, and they send the speeches to each other. Watch this. Here's how your kids. It's just been an unbelievable professional development. Win-win, that these kids are earning and hitting these benchmarks. At the same time, our teachers are growing because they're getting out of their silos, especially the small districts. There's one English teacher. There's one math teacher. They don't have other people that they can work within. So that's been a tremendous success, that the PLC component and elimination of the high school schedule that has been a stopper before. We've also really confronted the brutal facts on who are our kids earning dual credit right now and who are receiving expanded options money. And what we found is a lot of our expanded options and programs like this goes to a certain type of student. And that's the certain type of student who's getting through the finish line. A lot of our upper middle income white girls, to be honest. And what we're after are, let's get after these boys. Let's get after these first-generation kids. The experience like Bob has, the word is out that not only is it achievable if you're willing to work hard and put rigor into your junior and senior year, it's affordable. Because the Eastern Promise right now is $10 credit. And we have many of our districts who are using their expanded options money only for Eastern Promise classes for kids that are free and reduced. So that we get the access. So we know right now that in K-12, the least rigorous year in your entire experience is your senior year. 24-credit diploma. A lot of schools are on an 8-period day. Do the math. They're done by their junior. There's one required class. So if you were like me when we were 17 and 18, you know, we would take the one class, and we would take a little, maybe a weightlifting class, maybe a couple periods off. And then I don't take a very heavy load. And I go to the prom and I play football. Then the next year, guess what? I can't test into Math 111.
Right.
And so I'm paying $380 for a 4-credit remedial class that doesn't count toward anything, and very quickly I get priced out. That's our current system. Basically, your junior and senior year is dependent on who your parents are, and are they going to keep a highly rigorous schedule? Well, what we're saying is everybody's going to do that. At some of our smaller schools, pretty much what they're offering are these rigorous classes. Now, does that mean everybody earns college credit? No. Our worst case scenario, they took the class, they didn't pass it. They passed it for high school, but they didn't pass it for the college proficiency. And the worst case scenario, they took a very rigorous class their senior year, and they'll probably pass it their freshman year in college at Blue Mountain or Eastern. So that's been a real, real success story. There's a lot of elements that, you know, we don't have time with our parent outreach, with our fifth grade program. It's, as Bob mentioned, we started fifth grade, but one big key piece is our ninth grade class called Success 101. And that is piloted in Pendleton, and we're really going to expand that this next year. But what Success 101 is, we've adopted the curriculum from Santa Barbara. It called Career Choices. And it's a curriculum with textbooks and workbooks and whatnot, but it also has an online component. And what it's all about is demonstrating relevancy for high school class. And so my best example that I use in rural Eastern Oregon is sitting down with some of the boys saying, you know, do you want the Dodge Ram truck? Do you want the leather? Do you want the all the fancy bells and whistles and the Hemi engine? Well, that's about a $40,000 rig, man. So if you want that and you want a house about this size, you've got to have a job that pays about this. And this job requires you to have more than a high school diploma. which means, and works it all the way back, you got to finish Algebra 1, man. It's about that simple. Right now, leading, and what it's done is completely changed the conversation. I've heard from a lot of parents, the dinner conversation has changed. I've got to pass Algebra 1, Mom. I've got to get writing because that's what I need for the truck. And that is a kind of a fun little practical story, but it brings relevancy into the minds of freshmen. The beauty of this, we award college credit if they successfully meet the proficiency standards in Success 101 awarded by Eastern. Three credits. So think this through. You're a freshman in high school. You've already receiving a college transcript. The whole thing about first generation is they need to be in college while they're in high school to make them think they can be in college. So these kids are getting transcribed documents for their successful completion of Success 101. Here's another avenue we're looking at, our bilingual kids, okay, our ELL. Rather than looking at that as a weakness, looking at it as a strength, administering our Spanish, this is our next phase up, scale up in our region, is to develop proficiencies for Spanish for the 100 level series. I mean, theoretically, a hard working freshman that's bilingual might be able to pass that. That's a 12 credit series. There's 12 credits plus Success 101. These kids could be already around a 14 college credit. And these aren't giveaway credits. They have to meet proficiencies to do this that's established by the PLCs. But it's a game changer. It's a game changer in that these kids are actually going through this experience within and working toward completion. These aren't random dual credits because your teacher has a master's over here. These are OTM AAOT courses. So I think those are really the keys from the K-12 that I'm seeing such buy-in that it's no longer, oh, my high school schedule doesn't fit, or no, we just offer AP, or I can't hire a biology teacher that has the master's. It's now become systemic in our region. That here are the four 100-level classes. We're scaling up these four next year. You need to let us know who your teachers are that are going to be in the PLCs. Here's the dates for the PLCs. Remember, they get four college credits if they complete, et cetera. So
they have to show proficiency?
Yes. The teachers? It probably depends on what the proficiency is.
Well, actually, that's a very good question. And one of the things that is an interesting part about this is we are looking at the outcomes whereas dual credit looks at the incomes, are the inputs. At dual credit, the teacher has to have a master's degree in discipline and all of a sudden he or she is blessed. But we also know an individual with a master's in discipline may or may not be a very good teacher. A PhD may be not a very good teacher at that level.
Yeah.
With Chair Denbrough, obviously. Perfect exception. And so what we're looking at is how do their students perform? And so looking at the outcomes, when that teacher is in part of the PLCs, how are they grasping and gaining the material, and how are they working together with the other teachers? And then now you have a direct connection with the outcomes, and so we can take a look if a certain teacher has a pass rate of 5% because it's based on a standard, we know that we may need to work with that teacher in a very, very different way. So you're looking at, what are the outcomes? Where are we producing? What is coming out of those specific classes?
It's just like AP.
Yeah.
You evaluate how many of your kids got to a certain level, and if the teacher's not getting them there, you've got to have a conversation on why. And I think that will occur. I think it's been an eye-opener for some of the districts on the level of performance required as they watch them. My kids aren't there yet. But I think my son had the words out in the street with the kids, on the difference in the dual credit versus proficiency. And I think my son at the dinner table captured it for me. He says, Dad, when I take a dual credit class, that's a high school class I get college credit for. When I take a Eastern Promise proficiency class, that's a college class I get high school credit for.
Dr. Gallegos.
Yeah, I just
I'm just curious. It's very fascinating. I'm curious about the PLC mechanism. Has it been assessed by the Northwest Accrediting Association yet? And if so, how did that go?
We have, throughout the entire process, we go through Northwest Accreditation Systems on this, and they have blessed us all the way through. The master's degree level credit that the teachers are receiving typically does not count towards a master's degree. It's a professional development opportunity that would be part of their transcripts, and it's a very extrinsic motivating factor. And so, yes, Northwest.
And they find that, yeah, acceptable. That's great.
Yeah.
I've got my accreditation. Next year, we'll see.
You won't be there. Has your,
I'm on your team. So
yes.
It's been on his mind, though.
John, has your successor taken the promise yet?
Well, she's drunk the Kool-Aid. She's there.
Didn't have any choice.
As many of you are aware, my successor is Dr. Cam Preuss from Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and we feel very fortunate to have a great leader like Cam come out and take over the college. But she has been aware of Eastern Promise. She slipped us a few dollars over the years to help pay for it, because while it's cheap, it's not free, and I think Bob's going to talk to that in just a moment. And she's a believer.
And I think, do you have a question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's just sort of on a different line. It has to do with you talked about first generation, and I was interested in the diversity. And you know, my suspicion is a lot of the first generation folks have, young people have to work, and they're working through high school. How do you deal with the diversity issue, and are you dipping down into the K-12 to sort of, it seems you need to do some prep to get them ready?
Sure, I think we can all three answer that from our various perspectives, and it's an excellent question. As Mark discussed and put forward, the dual credit is one of the best kept secrets, and only a select group knows about it. With the Eastern Promise, what we have done is opened the floodgates with a lot of promotion about getting college ready and throughout the high schools. And so one of the I wouldn't say fears, but one of the things that we wanted to watch was, will this be cannibalizing dual credit? Will all of a sudden people stop taking dual credit and move into the Eastern Promise credit by proficiency? And therefore, are we just making, as Rudy Crewe once said, the same number of donuts, but just a different way? What we have found is that we have dramatically increased not only those individuals taking, obviously, the fourth pathway, 4,000 plus credits or thereabouts.
6,000 by the end of the year.
6,000 by the end of the year. But we've also seen a pretty good spike in dual credit, because all of our materials, all of our discussions is about the three or four different ways to get college credit in high school. And so we're seeing a very big blip, a very big jump in all of those efforts. With regards to the underserved, and there's many different ways that we talk about and measure that, first generation, diversity of ethnicity, getting more males excited about college beyond the football playing mechanisms Mark mentioned, but how do we diversify and get more students engaged? And we are seeing a very, very big spike in the diversity numbers as well. And again, because all of a sudden we've opened up a whole new discussion point, a whole new way to look at it, by talking and working with the families and bringing families and other social networks into it. Yesterday at Umatilla High School, we talked. I was talking with freshmen through seniors at the high school, and talking not necessarily just about the academic preparedness, but the social preparedness. And these individuals are from Hispanic backgrounds, and they talk very openly about, if they leave the Hermiston area, they're leaving their family, and that's a very, very tough deal. And so we started talking about how that works, and then bringing the parents in and having those very, very discussions, and laying that framework. We're working with a Four Rivers Charter School in Ontario, which is an amazing school. It's almost 100% Latina, and at the ninth grade level, we're working with them now and getting those college credits at that level and bringing the parents into it. And guess what? Now we're offering some of the dual credits, if you will, for parents, so that they're seeing what their sons and daughters are going through. And so most college readiness efforts focus in on academic preparedness.
Yeah.
We're looking at the personal preparedness. Can Johnny, Sally, Jose can Annabelle, can they set forward a mindset that they can personally take on those challenges, and then societal preparedness, making sure that the families are ready, that the communities are ready to support them as well. So it is a three-pronged approach.
And here's one thing we've done, I think, very well, is we've confronted the brutal facts and the secret, quote, secrets within our system. Here's the reality. We haven't had the capacity in dual credit to deliver for all families. So the people in the know get their kids in those classes. It was not hard for my boys to get an AAOT because I could make the system and the high school principals want to please me, which means a lot of kids didn't get into those classes. By the fourth pathway, we've taken that out of the mix, that we have the capacity. One thing we've talked about is, okay, you may be offering a speech, but how many sessions and who's in it? We've talked about that a lot. I think our next evolution to really, really get first-generation kids is a more deliberate effort, and this is people, and we're going to need people, to sit down with parents and students in August to say, here's your high school schedule. We cannot allow, because parents trust us. They trust us that we're putting kids in classes that they really need to be successful. And we don't always do that. And the parents who are heavily connected, heavily involved, know that, and they get the kids in those classes. We have got to have people to say, here's the deal, Jesus, you're going to be in 121. Here's the deal, Annabelle. You're going to be COM 111. It's $40. We're going to knock this out. You're capable of proficiency, getting that in there, and it's with this teacher at this time. That's really, for us, the next evolution I see for these families and kids, is we have got to that academic, and I'm not just academic advising. I'm deliberately looking at what classes they take through the system, starting their freshman year.
Rep. Wisner, you had a question, then Rep. Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got about four. First of all, Superintendent McIntosh and Superintendent Wilkerson sent me over here to be sure to take care of this. They want to get involved in this program, too. They're very impressed, as I think the committee is today, too. I'm just really disappointed. I don't think you had legislation to do this. How did you? I don't know. I wonder what authority you went to that diner and did this. About a pilot program or a study group or a task force.
Do I need to get my hands together for handcuffs? Or
it's really scary.
Chair Dembro, Representative.
Let me give you the other ones, and then.
Actually, we did have a bill last time.
Did we have a bill on this one?
I'll talk about it.
I thought we had to make them do this. Thank you for your dedication and involvement. But, you know, we're changing education now. You didn't go all the way to zero. We have a zero to six community out there that the governor has created now, and I'm really worried about. Are you going to meet in a diner to talk about the 0 to 6?
Oh, boy, can we answer that one?
Please stand for lunch this time. Okay.
And, you know, I'm trying to think outside the box. The speaker has one idea. I think that we're going to put this under education. We may want to look at involving ESDs who already cover the state in education and see if the local management oversight of 0 to 6 Early Learning Council could be placed there, because right now all I see is it being placed in Salem and someone out in Pendleton or Burns trying to provide parenting classes and things like that. So I'd be interested in hearing your comments on that. And also, I'm really scared like hell that you can offer $10 credits. You know, that's scary for this legislature, that you can do that for $10. So I look forward to President Davey's comments on the money and the credit and return on investment, which is another term that this body sometimes doesn't look at. So
I do have to jump in, though, Representative. These teachers are being paid through the K-12 budget as well, so it's not just $10.
Right. Can I answer the pre-K?
Sure.
Okay. This obviously fits right into a regional achievement compact.
Yeah.
And I've been corrected. I used to say P20. I've gotten really hammered by the health groups. It's prenatal to 20. Okay. So I, anytime anybody's watching, I now say that. So it's prenatal 20. We have a very, very aggressive effort for the whole pre-K piece as well. I mean, it's almost an Eastern Promise pre-K with the hub. Same players. One nice thing about Eastern Oregon for us to get things done is there aren't that many of us. And if we want to get it done, we can get it done. So we are working on that. Bob and I have started preliminary conversations on the Regional Achievement Compact. Like, Bob has a head start. I have EIE, CSE. It is a natural for ESDs. They're really the only ones that are P20 right now. But there is no question that I go into the hub meetings, and all I talk about is Eastern Promise because it's the same change process. And then vice versa on the pre-K as well. So we very much are tying the whole pre-K on how this is going to be. The Eastern Promise is right now fifth grade up. But there's no question our next step, it's the same people in the room. They're talking the same things.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I clarify that. So you're saying that you're going to be a hub if that ever comes forth, but if it's not, we're not anywhere close to a bill on that. You realize we've got 2 months left to go.
Correct. Yes. Yes. We already have outlined all the players, and I mean Bob, John. It's the same people that are going to be the hubs, the social services, Head Start, working toward the pre-K hub. We're going to do that even if it doesn't play out this way. We're going to do a hub.
Thank you.
With regards to doing this without a bill, sometimes you do the right thing without legislation, and that's what we did. We knew that we were charting new territory. We knew that we were moving forward, and we knew that this was something that was the right thing to do. We did look at the statutes, and there was nothing stopping us from doing it.
Bless you.
And so we like the good frontiermen that we are, we path our own chart way. As John said, is that this is a inexpensive way to deliver. It is not free. John reminds us every Tuesday morning, we're taking this out of Hyde. I don't know if I think I'm going to get a big plaque and say, taken out of Hyde when he retires.
Legacy.
That is his legacy. But it is not inexpensive. And yes, there are models that help pay some of it. But when we look at what how education is being funded in the state, I don't have to beat that bush. I beat that drum a lot. We do that in ways and means. But through House Bill 3232, is that correct? We do have a request for $5 million to make this scalable throughout rural Oregon, which when I say throughout rural Oregon, that's 34 of the 36 counties. And even the other two counties, we won't knock off our radar list as well. So we are looking for funding through this legislative process for these specific areas. We are dealing with a lot of people, as Mark mentioned, and as John mentioned, we're dealing with a lot of people, a lot of travel, and that is where a lot of the funding will go towards. We purposely, when we set this whole thing out in motion, we talked about having the cost per credit at 100, 50, 45, free. Our goal is to make this accessible, and we wanted to make that accessible, but at the same time, we wanted the students to have skin in the game. We didn't want it to be just, and there's an old phrase, if the value is what you charge for it, and if it's for free, there is no value, so we wanted to make sure that there was some skin in the game. But the financial aspect of this is not cheap, and right now we've been taking it out of Hyde. We're looking forward to the legislature process. Rudy Crewe is very much behind it. The governor is very much behind it. The governor came out to Pendleton about a month ago, and at the meeting we talked about the prenatal hub and whatnot and the Eastern Promise, and it is a seamless discussion. And so, yes, the research and literature shows that you need to start talking about colleges and university experiences at the fifth grade level. And that's why we chose that fifth grade level. But we do not ignore conception on up, I guess, is maybe the way we start looking at it. And that is a very important part and a very important role of the Eastern Promise. And as we look at Eastern Oregon University, Treasure Valley, Blue Mountain, ESDs, et cetera, it is that pipeline.
Thanks, Bob. And I'll want to take us back to Senate Bill 222 and the funding issue. But Rep. Greenlick first.
Thank you. To go from the sublime to the ridiculous, down to the ground level, I think two sessions ago, or maybe it was three, we passed a statute to input a college readiness exam at the 10th grade.
PSAT.
PSATs or, mm-hmm. or something. How does that fit into this, this model? It sounds like it would be a natural one.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We've had a lot of debate on this because a lot of research right now, as you know, is talking about the effectiveness of testing, and we have differing views on this. But there's no question we need some sort of assessment to help determine the success of the students in a college class, whether they're a freshman or in college or they're a junior in high school. We are administering the PSAT. We are also doing crosswalks with existing, like, OAKS. We're taking a look at Smarter Balance and how those crosswalk with college preparation for assessments. What we're concerned about is the degree of testing on high school kids. That's one more assessment for them. So what we're trying to find out, can we crosswalk our existing assessments to determine levels for placement for students? And we're also questioning, do we need placement with the proficiency the way it's set up? Because proficiency would argue against that.
The only function, as I remember, and I was involved in the committee that Tom was on, was to get kids to understand that they can be ready for college. I mean, it was to really implant in kids, like your kids, that, oh yeah, I can go to college. So, I mean, it seems to me it fits so completely into your program that it may be unnecessary. And that by the time they're in the 10th grade, they are ready getting that view. So I don't think we ever saw it as a proficiency. We saw it much more as a motivational influence to make the thought of college available for kids that otherwise would never, it would not have occurred to them by the 10th grade that they were.
But also to give a sense to those kids who maybe had a lot of makeup to do, you know, to give them a sense of where they were and what they would need to do in order to really become college ready. I think it had that purpose as well.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, Superintendent, you said you talked to the governor. And again, I'd like to, and maybe the chair could help me in this thing, but I'm really concerned. We've got less than 60 days, hopefully, to get out of here. And the Early Learning Council, the transition plan, the plan for the future has not been developed. I think, I'm not a PhD, I'm a taxpayer, and I represent taxpayers. And it makes a lot more sense if we've done...
That's
mutually
exclusive.
I was going to say. Doing both. And so, you know, the governor here wants to make it seamless from prenatal to 20th, whatever. But this early learning is this where we start. And you're not going to have those people in community college or high school if they don't get straight out in early childhood.
Right.
But go back to, as a taxpayer, we have ESDs. ESDs, since I've been in this building, we've been trying to get rid of you and do all this stuff, but you're there. You cover the state. And it makes so much sense to me from a financial standpoint, from an existing standpoint, to put these hubs in ESDs and where you're working to get to the governor's 40-40-20. I would hope the chair, or if you gentlemen have a chance to talk to the speaker on this, to say that that's, you've done it, you're working that way, whether it's been asked or not, and it thinks it fits together better than just going out with a pilot project.
Boy, can you and I go around the state and talk about that?
Yeah, so
I'm with you 100%. Okay. It's a natural.
But the point is, again, Mr. Chair and guest, we got less than 60 days. We don't have a plan for early childhood. There's no transition plan. There's going to be gaps in services. And I'm going to quit talking about that because
that's what we like. Yeah, well, let me just say that we'll try to get as much done this session as we can, but knowing that we're not going to get it all done this session. But I think if we can, you know, move things forward on what these gentlemen are working on, I think we'll have accomplished a lot. And that takes me back to the Senate Bill 222, which was a bill that I co-chief sponsored, but have kind of lost track of now. It's down in Ways and Means, I know. There's a component of it that would help with the funding so that students could apply, and those who are in need to help them with the cost of getting the college credit. I suspect that bill is going to have a good chance down there.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative Dembro. And I also wanted to real quickly comment on Representative Winsnett's comments. I agree with you 100% that these the hubs need to be placed with the ESDs. I would also say that they need to be co-chaired or co-placed or whatnot with universities and community colleges. We are in this together. I also want to say I do support you to get out in 60 days, too. I cannot pass that one.
Thank you. God bless you.
With regards to Senate Bill 222, I appreciate I did not know you co-sponsored that, but I appreciate that support. I did testify earlier this session on support of Senate Bill 222. I think it is a very important bill. It does work with the Eastern Promise. It does bring it to a highlight. It does provide grants and opportunities for students as well as other mini-grants for schools and others to work on this area. So I do hope it does pass. The return on investment of Senate Bill 222, the return on investment for HB 3232 and the investment that we were looking for is measurable and immeasurable. It's measurable in the number of credits that we will be able to provide throughout the entire state to students who do not have access normally to dual credit or other efforts. The Eastern Promise opens that door. It opens that door to students who live in rural areas where they don't have access to dual credit or AP. It opens the door to underrepresented students that do not know about it. And we can demonstrate specifically in those numbers of families impacted, specifically in the students that are impacted, and specifically in the number of credits that are advanced. And we can also specifically point to the number of students that go from high school and on into colleges, either at the community college level or at the university level, with those credits in pocket and the amount of dollars that they save and are able to graduate under 4 years or at the four-year mark because of the head start that they received. It's also immeasurable because of the benefits it has for the whole communities that they serve. All of a sudden, we are saying as a state that everybody deserves a chance to go to college. And right now, there's a lot of barriers in places that prevent that. Monument, Burn River, these small areas, college is as far away as France. And if we're able to bring it to them, to pipe it in, either face-to-face or through technology, as I know Representative Harker just loves, we're piping in credits into NISA and other areas because of this structure. And yeah, so, again, those are the immeasurable aspects.
I'm glad you bring that up, Bob, because I was going to ask about that. One of the things we talked about when we were creating Senate Bill 222 was the role of online education where, you know, you could also have a model in which, you know, a college instructor is teaming up with a high school instructor through, you know, distance learning and essentially co-teaching the class. And it's, you know, is that something that you're working on?
Yes, we are. And we are working on it. We're actually implementing it. We have a wonderful teacher in NISA who is an EOU graduate. We love EOU graduates who saw this opportunity and is working with our math department to do that very thing. And the neat thing about this as well is that now you've got high school students paired with college students. They're interacting, and the high school students are learning, oh, I can compete here. I can do this. And that, to me, is absolutely amazing to see that connection work.
And it's also the infrastructure to keep the whole thing together. You're talking the multiple meetings. I mean, you're talking phone bridges, right. Video conferencing. Yeah. I mean, at the ESD, we have three different rooms set up, and they're run all day long. It's what teachers, how they meet now. And so it's not just online learn. To my mind, online learning isn't just a class. It's the whole infrastructure of how you communicate and keep things moving.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, yes, Rick Gagos.
I just wanted to thank you. I quite honestly, I'm just impressed with your enthusiasm, and I find it very inspiring, actually. I guess I had a question that had to do with, it has to do with the governance. I mean, most of these my colleagues up here have been involved in the governance discussions much more than I have, and what I'm curious about and impressed with is the fact that this Eastern Promise is very clearly designed to fit the culture of Eastern Oregon. And I guess it's raising for me questions about sort of an overlay of governance and the need for localized, individualized sort of thinking, energy, and how that's different throughout the state. And so it's just something that I'm going to be thinking about. as we proceed. Thank you.
I'm thinking about governance, too.
That's great. Yes. So, colleagues, next week, I think on Wednesday, we're actually going to have a session on dual credit, and we're going to come back to a lot of this. You know, one of the weirdnesses of the way we do things here is that we have a bill, Senate Bill 222, which is of a lot of interest to us, but because it has a fiscal attached to it, it goes to Ways and Means. We don't hear it directly. But we will, I think, when we talk about dual credit, we will be getting a briefing from some of the people who presented on 222, and so it'll be an opportunity for us to, you know, to pursue that a little more. One thing that we have not done in this committee, and hopefully we'll do during the interim, is have a conversation about the Common Core. Mark, I think, mentioned Smarter Balance, which is the assessment part of the Common Core. And just, you know, we need to have a conversation about how is all this going to fit as we move into the Common Core. And in some ways, I think that may help us. And, you know, Common Core, the curriculum plus proficiency is a very powerful combination, it seems to me. So, Rep. Johnson, and we'll have to wrap up.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And about 222, I've had some involvement with that, too. And maybe a thought would be if we had a discussion about that, to invite in the members of the Ways and Means subs, that they could actually participate in the policy discussion before they go off and make the budgeting decision. But that's not my question.
No, we are not dealing with legislative silos. education silos,
yeah,
only.
We have those silos.
Right. I was able to get amendment or two into that bill, and I don't know how much attention you paid to it since it left Senate, Ed, but it deals with, and what Mark is talking about in terms of that final year within high school and so forth, and right now the state requires 24 credits for graduation. Districts can and do go above and beyond that, some do. In my district, for whatever reason, we require 26.5. So the amendment that I got in there is that, okay, for anything over and above 24, it says here, if a school district or public charter school requires a student to complete more than 24, the school district or public charter school may only require the student to complete additional credits for subjects where the Board of Ed has established academic content standards, meaning core curriculums, not electives. Courses required as part of a career to CTE type stuff, or dual accreditation type opportunity. So what it's going to do is force the discussion in school districts, which I think the latest data we had, there could be 30% of K-12 districts across the state that have require above and beyond 24, but it's going to require them to focus on, okay, if these kids are here for that last year, it's going to be something that's going to count post-secondary.
And that's wonderful.
Without mandating what they do, but they just have to do something that's going to be of substance and value and not just a study hall type of curriculum, if you will.
The only reason they're going above 24 is they don't have classes for those seniors.
Correct.
And they don't want them running the streets,
yep,
and they want them in class.
Right.
So the natural, rather than creating odd classes, why wouldn't you start your freshman year of college?
Exactly.
Automatically.
The other part of the amendment is there at the end is that community colleges shall collaborate with interested school districts that are within the boundaries of their district to facilitate delivery of 2+2 and other related programs as well. So it'll require conversations to happen, and the colleges are fine with that. But again, it just focuses that those conversations on how can we collaborate together to get kids out of here, not just with a diploma, but with something that actually is lasting, has value, and gets them a head start on that next step. So, it's a good bill.
Great.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Do you have any final say?
Some real quick final comments. First and foremost, I want to thank you for your attention to higher education, post-secondary education. This is a breath of fresh air that the legislators are really taking a very hard look about the way that we look at higher education, and I sincerely appreciate your leadership and your dedication. I also appreciate your support of the Eastern Promise and what we're doing out there in Eastern Oregon, and we look forward to not only just keeping it in Eastern Oregon, as you said, it does fit our culture, but it is also scalable across the state, and we look forward to doing that as well. And then finally, I do have to give two last jabs to my colleague to the right. He did mention his senior year that he did a lot of weightlifting and playing football. I am very pleased to say that Mark is indeed an Eastern Oregon University graduate. He did play football for us, and he holds a school record for the number of passes completed to the other team in one game. And I'm not thank you very much. And I did buy lunch, and thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all.
And I want to thank you so much.
Yes, this was really uplifting and informative. Thank you. Okay, so with that, I'll close this information hearing. Colleagues and members of the audience, have a great weekend. It's going to be lovely.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.
What time?